From the Atlantic to the Pacific, from mountain crest to mountain crest, from canyons to the clouds and into the cosmos, we are pumping wattage high and low, plus streaming worldwide on the internet and keeping you company tonight. It's the place to relax and hang out. I'm your host, Joshua P. Warren, and this is Speaking of Strange, giving you the latest and discussing the weirdest. We have assembled the finest team of reporters and the most intriguing guests, and that's why we are your favorite hub in a wild world. So keep it tuned right here. Oh, you know, I've been thinking about this hour for a while, how to condense this information down into an hour of Speaking of Strange. I'm in the studio with producer Forrest Connor. We have investigator Shelley Wright of Wright's Coin Shop. And, this is a story that I love so much because we have this sense that the history of our country sort of officially began when Columbus arrived, you know. And then we look back at the diaries and we look at the conquistadors and the early documents. But there was a lot going on in this country before Columbus arrived on this continent. And it's interesting to think that there had to be some point at which human beings were just barely learning the concept of language. And they were just starting to learn how to put marks on things. Now imagine this, if you were an explorer and you lived thousands of years ago in this area and you're walking off through the woods, there are no maps, you don't have any GPS, you're probably going to be guiding yourself by the stars, the sun, and the moon, right? That's the only thing that kind of more or less is consistent. And the most important things to you would be, where do I find water and where do I find food? You could bring your own shelter with you. You know, the early people learned pretty quickly how to use animal furs and hides for tents and stuff. So I imagine that some of the very earliest markings that remain on some of these old boulders probably indicate water, food, or something celestial. That would make sense, wouldn't you guys say?
Yeah.
I mean, just basic human needs. And yet, because these early people had no real connection at all to the English language, who knows what type of symbology at that time in some little circle was meaningful. Maybe it was a mark that was simply significant to that individual. It wasn't even shared by a community, right? Now, years ago, Forrest, you and I became really fascinated by Judicata Rock, which is near Cullowhee, North Carolina. It's not far from Western Carolina University.
Right.
It is a boulder that sits near a waterway off in the edge of the woods there, and it's covered with carvings called petroglyphs. And they all look very abstract. They just kind of look... they look weird because it's not like a caveman's paintings where you can look and say, oh, well, that's a horse.
That's the story of them going out and slaughtering the day's meal or whatever.
Sure, you know, this is a bull. They just look like abstract markings. And so there are all these theories, you know, about, well, are these star maps? Are these other types of maps? Was this something spiritual? Was it ceremonial? Well, we studied that area for a long time, and we found a lot of weird stuff related to that area. But the rock was named Judicata Rock because the Native American legend is that the Cherokee supposedly claimed that before they were around, there was a giant, a slant-eyed giant named Tsukalu, which the Europeans somehow pronounced as Judicata. And he ruled that area, and that he made those markings on the stone. One of the stories is that he jumped down from the mountaintop and steadied himself on it. And we actually discovered that there is a cave on the cliff above Judicata Rock. And the story was that Judicata lived in a cave. So we had a big, huge expedition We had Micah Hanks and Caleb Hanks, and gosh, I don't even remember all the people who participated. Brian Irish, the Fox brothers. Agnes Cheek was a part of that. We had a big, big group of people, and basically, you and I, well, we were the navigators, I guess you'd say. We took the faraway perspective, and by walkie-talkie and other means, we guided them up to the cave. And sure enough, there was a cave there, but there was nothing in it. So we're going to get back to Judicata Rock, but I wanted to start with Judicata Rock because that's sort of the beginning of it for us. Why is there this weird rock covered with all these markings that some geologists and archaeologists believe were put there 2,000 to 3,000 years ago? I don't even know how you would estimate that, but that's what they said. I guess they were looking at erosion patterns or something. So now let's fast forward to the year 2011. In late 2011, a new story started making the rounds about some ruins around North Georgia, around a place called Brasstown in the Chattahoochee National Forest, that at least one researcher named Richard Thornton claimed were ruins from early Mayan cultures that had come to our area. And if you look at a map, you'll see that, I mean, the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico, where all the Mayans often were, it just juts right out, and there's just one little channel of water there, and you go across that waterway, and boom, you're in Florida, you're in Georgia, right? I mean, it makes sense that right. in 2,500 years of their culture, their highly advanced culture, at some point, they would have crossed that water.
Crossed that water, yeah.
Yeah. But traditional archaeologists have always scoffed at this idea. Who knows exactly why that is? So when we started doing Paranormal Paparazzi, I suggested to the producers that one of the stories I cover as I headed down south was the story of these ruins. And so I traveled there to the Chattahoochee National Forest near Brasstown, Georgia, and I met with Richard Thornton. And he personally took us out into the woods. And I actually can tell you that was the most strenuous shoot that we did, because we're carrying all this equipment and stuff, and we're walking up this mountain. And the ruins are so kind of spread out that even he had trouble finding some of them. Now, I'm getting psyched. I'm hoping that I get up there and there's like a temple or something crazy, you know, a statue of Kukulcan up there. But I was really disappointed, because it looked to me like once in a while there were just sort of piles of stones that were sort of arranged like low walls. And he called these terraces. That, you know, he had a big illustration of how that if you start at the top of the mountain and you work your way down, there are kind of rows of these. Right. And I looked at them and I said, okay, well, clearly humans at some point in history have stacked up these rocks. How you make the leap from there to these were Mayan, I don't know. But what really interested me more than that was the actual boulders at the bottom of the mountain, the track rock boulders. I saw these boulders, and instantly I recognized that whoever had carved on those was the same group that carved Judicata Rock. If you go to Google and you type in Track Rock, Georgia, and just hit the images button and look at some of the pictures that pop up. And Forrest, I don't know if you can see on my computer, but these are some of the Track Rock images, okay? Does that, I mean, at first glance, it looks just like Judicata Rock, doesn't it?
We did, actually. Kelly and I were watching this a few weeks ago in Ozone, and we actually started saying that looks just like Judicata Rock.
Yeah.
Because we were talking about how, like, some of the patterns and the style is exactly the same.
Yeah. So you agree, Shelley, you agree as well, I'm sure, right? We all,
yeah.
There's no debate over the fact this looks like Judicata Rock.
Yes.
It does.
And I have heard rumors of there being other rocks out there like Judicata Rock, but I'd never actually seen it with my own eyes before. And knowing that this was supposed to be there, I brought some, when I went on this trip, I brought some blow-ups of some of the petroglyphs from Judicata Rock with me and held them up next to some of the petroglyphs on Track Rock and took pictures, and we videotaped it just to show how eerily similar they were. Now, Richard Thornton, he claims that he can identify some of these petroglyphs on Track Rock as Mayan symbols. Now, if that's true, then that's a big deal. And it also would show that the Mayans were not only there, but also in western North Carolina. So that was as far as I personally made it. So I left, you know, we had to move on to the next segment, and I had this question in my mind as to whether this was Mayan or not. I knew there was, you know, some early peoples had done this, and it was the same people who'd been in western North Carolina. Were they Mayan? I wasn't sure. Then I watched this program on H2 called America Unearthed, and there is a man named Scott Walter, W-O-L-T-E-R, who calls himself a forensic geologist. And so he's traveling around as the swashbuckling, no-nonsense, you know, Indiana Jones. He's one of these guys, he'll say, like, this is bull, beep, you know, like, oh, tough guy. He said BS on History Channel, huh? So anyway.
He's the Zach Bagans of archaeologists.
So he's traveling around, he's tackling this mystery, and they started off with him going to the same place. Well, okay, he went to talk to Richard Thornton, but he says they wouldn't let him go on to the site to actually see the same site I got to see. And I was like, well, that's weird. Why would you know? The only logical explanation is, okay, maybe enough people are convinced now that this may have some Native American archaeological significance, and they don't want people stealing it or trying to disturb it until it can be protected. I don't know. But anyway, I start watching this program, and fortunately, they only started off the program with that one site. And then he continues traveling all around the area. And that's when it started becoming really, really interesting. And he started compiling some great circumstantial evidence here. And when we come back to the break, I'm going to tell you about the circumstantial evidence that came together here. And why at the end of this program, given what I know already, or what I knew already, and now what I know, I believe this. I believe that the Mayans came here. But I'm going to add another weirdo layer at the end of this hour when we get back to how I think that may apply to Judicata Rock and stories of aliens and Judicata. So, hope you're keeping up with all this, my friends. And I think it's just a big, fascinating mystery. All the pieces will fall into place. This is the show where the unusual becomes usual. I'm Joshua P. Warren. This program is called Speaking of Strange.
I was a damn builder, walked the river. place called Boulder on the Wild Colorado. I slipped and fell into the wet concrete below. They buried me in that grave tomb that knows no sound, but I'm still around. Always be around and around and around and around. I'll fly a starship across the universal line, and when I reach the other side, I'll find a place to rest my spirit if I can. Perhaps I may become a highwayman again, or I may simply be a single drop of rain, but I will remain.
Pretty amazing to think back so far into the recesses of time that history itself becomes just a hazy, cloudy, foggy sort of shadow of how that what we call civilization developed. I'm Joshua P. Warren. You're listening to Speaking of Strange. Be sure to visit speakingofstrange.com for more information on the topics discussed and our live chat during the show. So I'm talking about some of these ruins in North Georgia. Now, I mentioned that the Track Rock ruins are near a town called Brasstown. And supposedly, and let me point this out. Track Rock has these markings that look like Judicolor. There are several others. There's one in Athens, Georgia, called the Forsyth Petroglyph, which also looks a lot like this. But Richard Thornton points out that the Mayans from Chichen Itza call themselves the Itza Mayas. They call their actual word for themselves, the Itza Mayas, was the word Itzate. So Itzate means the Mayans from Itza. And he said that when they came here in the early days and set up some of their earliest civilizations, the first missionaries arrived, and they heard that they were called the Itzate. But the missionaries had first talked to Cherokee and had used Cherokee translators in many cases. And the Cherokee word Itzaye means brass. And so you have several places in the area called Brass Town or Brassy This or Brass That. That itself could be a linguistic connection. But what makes it even more interesting is that the Maya, of course, when they would have settled, would have probably named some of these places after their culture. And all around Lake Okeechobee, there are villages there that were noted on the earliest maps. One of them is called Mayaimi. The other is Mayaka. And then there's one called Mayayuaka. And even Miami itself. Now, I actually, I heard this and I was like, well, let's see what I can find about the origin of the word Miami. So I started researching it myself. And sure enough, the official research says, we're not really sure where this word came on. Apparently there were some early settlers, we call them Mississippians, who were in the area, and, they came up with that word somehow. And I thought, that might be the clearest linguistic clue of all. Miami, especially if you look at the Yucatan Peninsula, and you can imagine them crossing that water, Miami would be one of the first places they might hit, depending on their angle, working with the currents. So you have these odd markings, and now we have these linguistic clues, right? But now here's where things get even more amazing. On this program, they show a copper breastplate that was unearthed at a site in North Georgia. And this copper breastplate clearly shows an intricate depiction of a guy standing there with kind of a bird-like head. He's got feathers in the background. He's holding some kind of a mace-like weapon in his right hand and a severed head in his left hand. Okay, this is very, very clear art. I've lived here my whole life. Cherokee didn't make stuff like that out of copper. Okay, none of the Native Americans hammered stuff like that out of copper. And yet in this program, this guy, Scott Walter, he actually went to the ruins at Chichen Itza and discovered a depiction there, a carving on one of the pyramids that is practically identical. I mean, they showed them side by side. You remember that part of the show there, Forrest.
Yes.
They showed them side by side. It looks like one of these Mayan, you know, bird god weirdy things, again, with a weapon here and a severed head there. So that's a pretty strong connection. Next, they found that in at least one burial site in Georgia, one of the skeletons had a cranial deformation of the type that was used by the Mayans, in which you would take a young child and you would pretty much wedge their head between a couple of boards to elongate their skulls. That's not something that our traditional Native Americans did, but they unearthed a bona fide cranial deformation skull in Georgia. There are a variety of odd mounds in that area. Now, a lot of them are very worn down, but some of them are still quite clear. And some of them have nice long tunnels to go inside of them. One great example are the Okmulgee Mounds
in Macon.
Macon, Georgia. Yeah. Now, so you have all this stuff that's kind of adding up, but here is the straw that kind of breaks the camel's back when you're watching the show. Forrest, have you ever seen the movie Apocalypto?
Yes.
It's a great film, isn't it?
It is.
Have you seen it, Shelley?
Nope.
You still haven't seen that? Well, there's a scene in Apocalypto in which I would say the best depiction of a Mayan sacrificial ceremony ever done in cinema history is presented on screen. And they're taking these guys who are about to be slaughtered, and they're painting them blue. Because there was, the Mayans had a fascination with a particular shade of blue, which we now know simply as Mayan blue. And there are still traces of Mayan blue on ruins down there that have been around for thousands of years. Now, when they've analyzed Mayan blue, they found that the Mayans made this dye, this blue dye, by mixing together two main ingredients. One, a type of clay called palygorskite, and two, a type of plant indigenous to the Mayan region called anil. So you mix the anil with the palygorskite clay, and you get this nice, rich, kind of mystical blue color. And they love this color so much, they apparently would smear it on all of their sacrificial victims. Because right there at Chichen Itza is a huge, big sinkhole full of water. You may have seen this on various TV programs. They usually point it out. And they would kill kids and stuff, and they'd throw them into this big sinkhole. So divers have gone into the sinkhole, and they find just the whole bottom is riddled with skeletons and bones. But the very, very bottom of the sinkhole is 14 feet of Mayan blue dye. So clearly, I mean, they were liberally using this dye. The funny thing is, even though the anil plant is prevalent down in the Central America region, the palygorskite clay is not that plentiful. There are only two or three sites where it's been found. And they can't figure out how they got so much of this palygorskite clay to make as much dye as was being used. Well, guess what? Georgia is just chock full of palygorskite clay. So we start to see this possibility that the Mayans were shipping this clay down to their home civilization to make this valuable dye. It'd be no different than the culture shipping spices or herbs or, you know, coffee or whatever you can get paid for, right? Whatever's of value. So this guy, Scott Walter, wondered, if this could be the solid scientific connection, what if we can prove that Georgia clay was being used in authentic Mayan blue dye? So we're going to take a break. When we come back, I'll tell you about the test that he conducted and what the results were. I'm Joshua P. Warren. We're talking right now about the Mayan presence in North America, and trust me, it's going to get pretty weird at one point. You're listening to the show where the unusual becomes usual, Speaking of Strange. Astronomy. They were a powerful culture for 2,500 years.
No, they just stayed in one place, Joshua.
It's the tendency to travel, to explore, that is the sign of an empire. Of course they traveled. And it makes so much sense when you just look at this on a map, you know, just the logic of it. They would have come here. But what is the evidence? What is the physical evidence? Well, this is Speaking of Strange. I'm Joshua P. Warren. And in this program called America Unearthed on H2, Scott Walter, the forensic geologist, he took some samples of authentic Palygorskite and anneal Maya blue dye from Mayan ruins. And one of the reasons it can last for thousands of years is because it's a very durable clay. He took an actual sample of the Mayan blue, and then he made some Mayan blue from the Georgia Palygorskite with some anneal plant in his lab. He took both of these samples to the X-ray diffraction lab in Minnesota, and they X-rayed both of these samples, and they ended up with a little graph that shows highlights of, you know, what the minerals and stuff are. It's just like the fingerprint of that mineral. And it was an exact match. Just an absolute, they said it couldn't have been a more exact match. So they are claiming through this program, and from what I see, if everything they presented is accurate, and from the research I've done, it appears to be, that this is undeniable, rock-solid scientific proof that there was a Mayan presence in the area around Georgia, Florida, western North Carolina. And if they, you know, of course, it does make sense that these would have been outer bands of the Maya. So it's not like they came here and, you know, dominated, set up, you know, fortresses and things. It'd almost be like if a group of, say, you know, German immigrants sets up a community somewhere. Years after that, when they're gone for whatever reason, you might still see some of the structures have a little German bent to them, you know. So it also makes sense that if you lived in a culture that was as frightening as the Mayan culture was, where these guys are dressing up like god-awful looking monsters and demons and sacrificing children and stuff, it makes sense that you might want to go on a field trip. You know, go out and say, oh, I'm going to go explore this area for a while. You guys have fun here. So if they came here and there are still traces of it here, it's one thing when you find something like this breastplate that has a clearly distinguishable Mayan image on it that you can compare to another. But there's still one final mystery. If these rocks, like Judah Color Rock, like the Track Rock ruins, like the Forsyth petroglyph, if they have markings that were made by those Mayan groups, why do those markings still have this abstract kind of appearance, right? Why are they not like the breastplate? Or if you go to the Mayan ruins, especially at a place like Chichen Itza, you see very distinctive, well-made, precise, artistic depictions of things. Why don't we have that level of artistry on these ruins? Well, this brings me to my new little outrageous conspiracy theory. And it's not that far off, really, from some of the stuff I've talked about before. Earlier, you know, when I was talking about comparing these rocks, I should have brought up that if you go to one of our websites here, judahcolorrock.com, you can see a photograph of Judah Color Rock. And now, again, this is the one that sits around Cullowhee, North Carolina. And that's spelled J-U-D-A-C-U-L-L-A, judahcolorrock.com. We'll put a link at speakingofstrange.com. If you go there to the website, you will find a photograph that was made of Judah Color Rock, I believe sometime in the 1930s, by a man named Silas Parker. And last I was doing research there, one of his ancestors, a man named Jerry Parker, owned the land nearby. He'd owned the rock for a long time, but the family finally sold it to Jackson County. Now, what's great about this old photo is that in the 1930s, when Silas Parker took this picture, he knew that this rock was significant enough that he took the time to sort of fill in all the petroglyphs with kind of this white chalk or something like that. So they really stand out. They really pop very nicely in this high-resolution black and white photo. Last time I was at Judah Color Rock, unfortunately, the rock has been so neglected. It's sinking into the ground. There are students from the local college coming there, carving graffiti into it, breaking chunks off of it for souvenirs, just abusing it, you know, sitting on top of it, drinking beer, whatever. So the rock is degrading quickly now. And if indeed these carvings were made thousands of years ago, it shows you either A, just how grand the rock once was, and or B, how sacred it was, that, you know, maybe it was sheltered. Maybe they didn't let people crawl around on it, certainly not carve graffiti into it. So if you look at this rock at judahcolorrock.com, and then as you do, as I said earlier, and you go to Track Rock, Georgia, and you look at some of the pictures and you see how similar they are, and you do the same thing with the Forsyth petroglyph. What do these things look like? What do they immediately strike you as? Well, I will tell you, the very first time I went to Judicola Rock and looked at it, I was hit by this kind of gut intuitive feeling. There are a lot of different theories as to what this may be, what the rock may represent. But when I was a teenager, I wrote a children's book called The Lonely Amoeba, which is about microscopic characters. Emo Amoeba, Larry the Hairy Paramecium, Gina Euglena. It's like a Dr. Seuss book written rhyming verse style. So I'd done a lot of research on microscopic organisms. And the first time I saw Judicola Rock, it kind of looked to me like this big soup of microscopic forms and figures. Like, in fact, if you go to the website, you'll see that I even have a page. Let's see. Okay, it's still there. I haven't been there in a while. That shows a comparison between one of the petroglyphs and an amoeba, or one and a type of worm, a microscopic worm called a Brucei worm, and then one comparing it to a diatom, and then one comparing it to a form of bacteria, and one comparing it to a hydra, etc. I mean, you can see these comparisons laid out very clearly for you. And if these markings were made thousands of years ago, but a microscope was not invented until about, best I recall, about 300 and some years ago, then how is that possible? How could anybody who lived thousands of years ago have known that could have known that microscopic organisms exist? So yeah, here I just found it. Yeah, microscopic life was discovered around 350 years ago. That's when it was very first discovered, when the microscope was invented by Anton van Leeuwenhoek. It doesn't make any sense. It seems counterintuitive. There were no microscopes thousands of years ago, so how could these possibly have a relationship to microscopic life? Now, bearing that in mind, remember that the Mayans lived their lives around the idea that they were being visited by gods from the sky. Maybe that's one reason the Maya blue color was so important to them, because the sky is blue. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I'm going to tie all this together in terms of a new theory, if you want to call it that, regarding why these depictions on these stones might actually be depictions of microscopic organisms that were left there by the Mayans. I'm Joshua P. Warren. It's the program where the unusual becomes usual. It's called Speaking of Strange.
He was in a bind, but he was way behind, and he was willing to make a deal. When he came across this young man sawing on a fiddle and playing it hot, and the devil jumped up on a hickory stump and said, "Boy, let me tell you what. I guess you didn't know it, but I'm a fiddle player too. And if you care to take a dare, I'll make a bet with you. Now you play pretty good fiddle, boy, but give the devil his due. I bet a fiddle of gold against your soul, because I think I'm better than you." The boy said, "My name's Johnny, and it might be a sin, but I'll take your bet, and you're going to regret, because I'm the best as ever been. Johnny, you're awesome, up your bow and play your fiddle hard, cause hell broke loose in Georgia, and the devil deals the cards. And if you win, you get this shiny fiddle made of gold, but if you lose, the devil gets your soul." We'll be right back. up his case and he said, I'll start this show. And fire flew from his fingertips as he rosined up his bow. And he pulled the bow across the strings and it made an evil hiss. And then a band of demons joined in and it sounded something like this.
The devil once go down to Georgia? Did he even come up here to Western North Carolina? The slant-eyed devil, they called him. The devil's courthouse was one of his domains. That was considered one of the realms of Judicola, where at night he would hold all these crazy parties and with little demons and dwarves and fairies, and they would dance around and have orgies and whatnot as they peered down on the valleys below. Well, the Maya, they worshipped gods that came from the sky. Now, we talk about Judicola a lot because Judicola was just one of these gods who supposedly was a peaceful one. He was almost a Christ-like figure, trying to get people to cooperate, and he didn't like all the sacrifice that was going on. A lot of that was inspired by some of the more, you know, dark, bloodthirsty beings. And they seemed, those gods seemed to be preoccupied with gold. And we've talked about that on the show before. Why is it that they may have been so interested in gold? Well, it's a long story, but if you read my book, The Secret Wisdom of Kukulcan, it explains all that. But if for a period of time the Mayan people were being ruled by these large, scary-looking beings, these aliens, these big aliens that came down from the sky, then it would make sense that if they traveled to this area, and by this area I mean the south, what is now the southeastern United States, then some of these scary beings would have come along with them. Maybe they were the supervisors. Maybe they were here primarily to look for gold. But we also know that the Mayan people, they were interested in this Palygorskite clay to take back. Regardless, they were interested in the geology. They were interested in the microscopic. And therefore, if these aliens, like Judicola, if they came here and were advanced enough to travel and rule these people for that while, they may have had microscope type technology. And so as they traveled on these voyages with these big scary giant alien supervisors, they were using microscopes to look at the profile of a place, and that basically when you see one of these boulders, you are more or less looking at a schematic of the microscopic profile of the work that was being done at that place at that time, or some other type of indicator about that area and the characteristics of that area, which could be used for follow-up work. And that the idea of aliens, big creepy aliens with advanced technology, intermingling with the Maya and ruling them for a while, and then subsequently all coming to explore what is now the Southeast and leaving these traces behind, fits together for me as a possible bit of circumstantial proof that the Maya were not only here, but when they were here, they were in possession of advanced technology, And if we believe them and take them at their own word, that technology was provided by these aliens and gods. And so we may have, therefore, even more evidence, not only for a Mayan presence, but evidence for these ancient alien visitations that were interpreted as gods. We've got about a minute before our break, and then we'll have the dark 30-hour. Forrest, Shelley, what do you think?
I think there's some tweaking that needs to be done. I wouldn't necessarily call them microscopes, but maybe they had the technology to be able to see something.
Right.
Yes, it's microscopes. Maybe it's not microscopes as we know it. Maybe it's the ability to be able to see some. I'm trying to figure out how to say it.
A tool that will see that level of
light. Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
And of course, you know, if they didn't have these nice pieces of paper back then, so, you know, mm-hmm. they were just drawing on or chiseling out whatever they could to tell their massive workers or whatever, hey, this is what we're looking at. This is what we're looking for. Maybe this is what you need. This is when you're doing your work, look for this here.
Shelley, we'll get your thoughts when we come back because we're almost out of time here. But, you know, 2012 was considered a turning point for the Mayans. Maybe the simple acknowledgement that they came here and did this is part of that. It's going to be the dark 30 hour when we come back, when we dig into the really weird, crazy stuff. I'm Joshua P. Warren. It's Speaking of Strange.